Hello and welcome to the Patreon Party People Podcast. It is April the 29th, we'll say, of 2020, and of course I am your host, Ryan Bloom. Hi and welcome to my Patreon Party People Podcast, everyone. That's the name of the show. Already kind of a mess starting this podcast off. I've actually been thinking, like, as an aside, before we get into the usual nonsense that this podcast is meant to represent, I've actually thought about changing the name of the podcast a little bit. But, you know, I go back and forth a lot. Technically, this was started as an exclusive podcast for my Patreon donors. It does, you know, obviously end up getting posted on YouTube eventually, you know, a month after it's current. And like the whole thing was that this was, you know, a way to keep my patrons up to date on the things that I'm doing, you know, articles I'm writing, games I'm developing, videos I'm producing, things like that, you know, just kind of like a check-in every month to see how things are coming along. But I've also just thought, like, you know, the Patreon Party People Podcast is kind of a bad name for a podcast in general, as something that only exists, you know, kind of as like a monthly update, sort of almost like a newsletter, as it were. It's fine. But as a wider podcast at large, you know, there's all these considerations to take into mind, like, you know, what if the podcast could bring in new Patreon donors, if it was, you know, named better, and I had a more consistent listener base, you know, things like that. That's just something that goes on in my mind every now and then. I have no plans, I have no, like, names in mind for a new podcast name, nothing like that. It's just something that I consider every now and then, whether or not Patreon Party People Podcast is a good name or not. I suppose it's not, like, the worst name in the world, right? The other thing is, like, maybe it's a little bit misleading. Like, you know, maybe I'm representing Patreon in some way, and I don't really want to give off that impression, as it were. So I don't know, just things that happen in my brain from time to time. But hello, how are you all doing out there on the internet? I hope you're doing well. I am getting through days as best as I can. I think we all are, you know, none of us is in this alone, as it were, this pandemic, as it were, the P word that I'm probably not supposed to say, because apparently if you actually say, like, get too specific, because it's been so politicized or whatever, I mean, I don't even know, YouTube does apparently, from what I've heard, anecdotally, turn off your monetization, because it's now considered, like, a political issue. So maybe I shouldn't be saying pandemic, but I'm saying pandemic. That's the kind of person I am. What a weird intro. You may be wondering, if you remember last month's podcast, I was talking about an upcoming April Fool's joke involving a Bubsy the Bobcat fan game. That never came out. It is still sitting here on my hard drive. You may be wondering where it went, what happened to it, why didn't it come out? Simple fact of the matter is, I ran out of time. I was complaining, I think, at the end of last month, that ripping sprites was a big problem, because there are some Bubsy rips out there for, you know, his character sprites and some of the enemies, not all the enemies, but some of the enemies. But as far as level graphics go, that was the real headache that was kind of getting in my way at the time, was basically having to go through and manually rip every single element of the first level of Bubsy. Because I said, you know, I never really specified how long this fan game was supposed to be. I kind of just wanted to do, like, the first world, you know, the first, that's like two or three or four levels. And even just then, like, you would not believe the graphical diversity in the first world of Bubsy Clawed Encounters of the First Kind. You have, you know, all these hills, you have waterfalls, you have, like, sewer sections, cave sections, sections in cities, sections where you're, like, climbing up cliff sides, there's water slides, There's like weird dock sections. There's a lot of graphical diversity in the first world of Bubsy, and I was trying to go through and rip it all. And some of it was easier than others. You know, obviously level tiles aren't that bad. Static images, as it were. But when it comes to, like, you know, the parallax background, that's animated. The water slides are animated. The waterfalls are animated. You know, there's like jumping potted plants in some areas. There's just a lot of weird stuff that's really hard to like figure out. Because for a time, I was also trying to rip them properly, as it were, you know, with the correct dimensions so that they would fit together easier when I started building the level. And that got scattered to the four winds because, first, I'm terrible at math. So, you know, figuring out, you would think, oh, you know, maybe it's just like a multiple of 8. Because that's kind of like the whole thing with these old consoles. Everything was like a multiple of 2 or a multiple of 4, multiple of 8. So, you know, 2, 4, 8, 16, 32, 64, 128, 256, 512, 1024, 2048, 4096, you know, dimensions like that. And apparently that's not the dimensions that the Bubsy tiles fit into. And if they do, I don't know how they fit in there. You know, there's margins to consider, empty margins that are kind of difficult to figure out. It all just kind of turned into a headache. I figured it out eventually, or I figured it out enough to where I could start building a level, just a single one level. And I got probably about a quarter or a third of the way through building one level, and then April 1st hit. And I wasn't ready. I wasn't finished. And I ended up like really tangling with this problem. Something that's like been like a big thorn in my side for years and years and years and years with ClickTeam Fusion software is corruption, data corruption. You know, this software has a legacy of like 30 years at this point. It goes all the way back to Click and Play in like 1995 or 1994, maybe even earlier than that, I don't know. And data corruption, for as long as I've used ClickTeam products, has been a problem. Many fan game and original game projects of mine have been killed because of data corruption. If you remember many, many years ago, Sonic the Fated Hour, like my first big famous fan gaming project from like 2001, I remade that engine, the engine that powered the game, like, you know, all the player physics, all the enemy, artificial intelligence, things like that. I remade that engine like 7 times. And at least 2 or 3 of those times was because of data corruption, because at some point, something random inside the code, something random inside the graphics, something random inside the project file would become corrupted, and it would spread throughout the whole game, and it would make it crash when you did like specific things. It would just act generally weird. I mean, that happened like, you know, several times after that, where just, you know, whatever they do with their weird scripting language or whatever doesn't line up in the data quite right. So eventually you reach a point where, you know, the executable expects one thing, the code is saying another thing, and the editor can't tell the difference between what is right and what is wrong. And that leads to data corruption, where it stops functioning properly, and there's nothing you can do to fix it. And this is what I thought happened to Bubsy. Because if you don't know, I built Bubsy on top of something called Not So Simple Sonic Worlds. That's another code base entirely. Somebody else developed it. It was kind of a fork of the Sonic Worlds Delta code base, that kind of, you know, removed some things, simplified it a little bit more, kind of got rid of some of, but not all of the bloat, which is why I picked it to, you know, develop this Bubsy game. Did I say that right the first time? I don't even know. I am so inside my own head thinking about this. Anyway, I was using Not So Simple Sonic Worlds. And because it's, you know, a Sonic code base, even though it's been, you know, slimmed down, all these features were removed that weren't strictly necessary, it still had a lot of stuff that Bubsy wouldn't use. You know, you could play as Tails, you could play as Knuckles, you could play as Shadow the Hedgehog, you could play as Amy Rose. It didn't need any of that stuff. So, you know, at some point, even before the last podcast, I was kind of going through and sort of ripping out code as I did not need it. I was ripping out sprites that I did not need. And I ended up encountering this weird bug where Bubsy would enter a state where he could not jump, he could not fall. He was just kind of stuck in his jumping animation while the sound of, like, destroyed enemies kept playing. You know, it was like this pop, 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 like really, really rapidly. And you couldn't really control the game. You couldn't really do anything. And I figured that was just data corruption. I learned very quickly that if I ripped out a piece of code that did that, and that bug happened where, you know, Bubsy couldn't really move, he was stuck in his jumping animation, that meant I should revert to a previous save because maybe I pulled something out that I wasn't supposed to. And it came down to where it was like March 30th, March 29th, and there was a specific piece of code that I needed to rip out because it wasn't working right, it was buggy or something, and if I removed that code that wasn't working right, it triggered this bug. And I tore my hair out for like 48 hours trying to figure out, how am I going to work around this bug? Is this data corruption? Is this whole Bubsy project just flushed down the toilet? You know, it was kind of a nightmare. And I spent, you know, up to and past April 1st trying to fix this bug. And to be perfectly honest with you now, like, since that was literally almost a month ago, I don't remember what I did to fix it. I don't even remember what the problem was. But it turned out I don't think it was data corruption. At one point, I'd ripped a sprite out. I remember this part. So one thing that they added to Click Team Fusion over the years is being able to embed code into objects, right? So you have, this is going to be kind of a complex explanation for some of you. You have objects, right? Objects are sprites. That is items you collect, that is player characters, that is enemies. Objects, right? That's what an object is. It is an animated object that can have collision. An actor, as it would be called in some other programming languages. And Click Team added the ability to embed code into objects, which could then be referenced outside of the object by other things in the code. So you'd have this kind of weird nested code system. And I learned many, many years ago never to touch this, never to embed code inside of objects, because that was a really good way to get your program to crash, because if it's trying to reference code embedded inside of an object, the game kind of freaks out. And it came down that some genius at some point had embedded code inside of the InstaShield graphics that was being referenced inside the main code itself. So it was referencing nested code in the main code, and I myself was a genius and deleted the InstaShield graphics. But the main code was still referencing the nested code inside the InstaShield object. And I think somehow that ended up being the bug that was causing what was either corruption or just some other weird thing. And somehow, I don't remember how now, I ended up figuring out a way to remove the InstaShield embedded code that was referenced in the main code so that it would actually stop triggering this bug. And that, you know, that, like I said, that whole mess, if you didn't understand anything I just said, that's fine. I barely understand it myself. Obviously, if I'm having trouble remembering what I did. Obviously, I fixed it. You know, I know how I fixed it. I just don't know how I fixed it. I'd have to actually, like, open the project file here and look it up. But that took me past April Fool's. You know, by the time I fixed that, it was like 7, 8 p.m. on April 1st. And I decided, you know what? No, we're skipping April Fool's again this year. And the idea was that, you know, I keep working on it, and I did keep working on it, and, you know, eventually at some point in April I'd release a Bubsy thing, and that also never happened because a lot of other things happened this month. You know, Final Fantasy VII Remake came out like the first or second week of April. That came out and just totally sidelined everything else I was doing. I've written like other reviews too. Panzer Dragoon Remake came out for the Nintendo Switch. I think that actually came out a little bit before Final Fantasy VII. So I think it was this case where I was working on Bubsy. Excuse me, allergies are dripping down my throat here. It was this case where I was working on Bubsy, you know, I was fleshing out the level. Like I said, I got about, I don't know, 25-20% done with a level. And the Panzer Dragoon Remake came out for the Nintendo Switch. We'll talk about that later in the podcast. Then almost immediately after I finished Panzer Dragoon Remake, after I finished the review for Panzer Dragoon Remake, Final Fantasy VII Remake came out. And, you know, I've been kind of chewing away on that for the last, I don't know, 2.5 weeks now. So, you know, that's kind of sidelined Bubsy for now. Now I'm sort of sitting here thinking, you know, what should I even do with this Bubsy thing? Because I have a pretty functional Bubsy code base. I have part of a level, not a whole level, not even half of a level, but part of a level. What should I do with this? And honestly, I don't know. Maybe after I'm done with Final Fantasy VII Remake, you know, maybe then I'll get back to Bubsy, but, you know, we're going to talk about things here later in the podcast. I don't think that's really going to be something that I'm doing. There are other ideas that I want to mobilize on, which means that I kind of wasted 3 months on a fan game project that is now, A, going to be public knowledge once that podcast goes up on my YouTube channel, and then B, didn't go anywhere. So I don't know what to do with that. And, you know, I've been writing on other things, this month. I said I worked on and finished the Panzer Dragoon Remake review. I'm about halfway done with both Final Fantasy VII Remake the game and Final Fantasy VII Remake the review, as it were. It's been this weird thing where I've been working on the review for Final Fantasy VII as I play it. Usually I wait until I'm finished with the game before I'm finished with the review. But I was kind of chomping at the bit to get going on this review. I've been, you know, if you've been paying attention to my blog, I think I've talked about it here on the podcast every now and then. I have a lot to talk about with regards to this game, about my feelings about its art style, its battle system, everything else. So, you know, I've already gotten started writing the review. I've also been writing on other, like, weird small projects since then. Speaking of my blog again, you may remember that at one point I had this weird random idea where I figured I would quote-unquote predict Ghostbusters 3, which was a weird thing for me to do in retrospect. I don't even remember why I decided to do that, but it's something that I did, and it ended up like this weird bullet-pointed list of like a Cliff Notes version of a movie script, which was really, again, very weird. I don't know why I did that. It was just something that had to get out of my brain, apparently. And something else had to get out of my brain. At one point, I was thinking about the Sonic the Hedgehog movie and, like, what a sequel to that would be. And so I guess I started writing fan fiction about that? That's a weird thing for me to say, I realize. Like, I know I'm not the type to read fan fiction. I'm not the type to write fan fiction. I probably haven't written real, actual fan fiction since I was, like, 17 years old. But I started writing sort of like another Cliff Notes version of a movie script. It's not a bullet-pointed list like that Ghostbusters 3 thing was. It is very much, you know, more of a quote-unquote story, as it were. It's not like a movie script or anything like that. It's just sort of describing what I'd think plot points in that movie would be. And, like, the moment I realized what I was doing, that I was writing fan fiction, I kind of stopped working on it because I was weirding myself out. I've never done anything like that before. And I probably wrote about half a movie's worth of stuff. It's, again, like, it's more detailed than that Ghostbusters thing, but it is not what I would call, like, a full script. It's probably what would, some would consider, like, a first draft pass, let's say. And maybe I'll throw that up on Patreon at some point. But again, it's not finished. It's probably maybe about halfway done. Some of it is more detailed than others. It's a real weird thing, but it's something that I felt like I had to get out of my head, I guess, and I can't really explain it better than that. I've often explained, actually, you know, sort of a tangent here. I've often explained my writing process as that, right? Is that I have an idea that gets stuck in my brain, and it sort of starts to drive me crazy until I get it out of my brain. You know, that is how my Dissecting a Hedgehog article got written, if you remember that. That's why I started writing video game reviews. That's why I started doing, like, video reviews on YouTube, is because I had this idea in my head, and it wouldn't get out until I pulled it out, and I did it. And I guess that's kind of what's happening here, is that I get ideas in my head, and they have to get out somewhere, or else I'm going to go insane. So it's a weird, I'm a weird person. That's what I am. I'm a weirdo. Anyway, something else I've been thinking of, it's been increasingly on my mind more and more and more lately, getting into things that I want to do sort of after the Final Fantasy VII Remake review is done, is I've been thinking more about that Knights video. You may, like, remember that I've talked up, like, a Knights documentary, Knights into Dreams, for the Sega Saturn. And it's a script that I wrote probably at least 5 years ago at this point. And if you really think about it, it goes even further back than that. And it's something that I've never produced because, you know, it'd be a huge video. It would easily rival my How Do We Fix Sonic video, right? It would easily be at least 30 minutes, probably even closer to 40 minutes long. It would be really, 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 really involved to make. And for that reason, I've been very afraid to make this video. But, you know, next year, 2021, will be, I think, the 20th or 25th anniversary of Knights into Dreams coming out. That game came out, wait, I'm going to do the math here, because that game came out in 1996. So it will be the 25th anniversary of Knights into Dreams. Yes, I had to use a calculator for that. Shut up. I said, yes, shut up. People who are not even actively part of this conversation, shut up. I told you I'm bad at math. Anyway, next year will be the 25th anniversary of the release of Knights into Dreams. And if that video is going to take me so long to produce, maybe now would be a good time to get on that. So I've been looking over that script again, you know, kind of proofreading it again, probably like the millionth time I've reread that script since I wrote it back in 2014, 2015. I don't even know. I don't think Google Docs tells me how far back these things go. It just says, you know, when the last update to the article was. But it has been a very, very, very long time coming. Like, I have memories as far back as when I was writing user blogs on GameTrailers.com, having this idea for a Knights video. And I remember a friend all the way back then, I couldn't even, like, run a Sega Saturn emulator. I didn't have video capture hardware yet. And a friend offered to capture footage of Knights into Dreams for me so that I could put together this Knights video. That's how far back this idea goes. Before I even had video capture hardware, I've wanted to do a Knights into Dreams video. And, you know, it's evolved over time as, you know, why I've wanted to do this video. I don't even remember the original impetus for wanting to do a Knights into Dreams video all the way back then. We're talking like 2005, 2006, somewhere around there. Maybe even like 2007, because that was probably, you know, right around the time that I was getting into wanting to do video production. That was right around the time I was getting into wanting to do, like, buying a video capture device. And, you know, again, I don't remember that far back, but I know that at one point, it was probably, you know, this is like a really silly, like, inspiration, as it were. But, you know, I used to listen to a lot of the Giant Bombcast. And Jeff Gerstmann hates Nights into Dreams. And, you know, Giant Bomb has done a few videos here and there on Nights over the years, where it's very clear that certain members of the Giant Bomb staff don't actually know how to play that game, like, at all, even remotely. So, you know, it was, part of it was born out of that, sort of like this idea that, oh, nobody knows how to play Knights, maybe I need to explain how to play Knights, maybe I need to explain why Knights plays the way it does, the inspirations behind the game, like the point of the game, what it's trying to do, and then at some point after that, you know, maybe that was even like the original impetus to begin with, all the way back in 2005, you know, maybe I was listening to like The Hotspot, which was GameSpot's podcast, which also featured Jeff Gerstmann and Ryan Davis and Brad Shoemaker and Vinny Caravella, you know, all those guys way, way back then before they formed Giant Bomb. Maybe that was even the original impetus, was me hearing them talk mess about Knights and thinking, I should do something about that. But also, you know, over the years, shortly, probably within a year or two of it ending, I had some friends that were doing a podcast, the Nitro Beard podcast. It was eventually called something else. It was called Free to Play. You know, it was just a group of friends of mine. They did a weekly podcast about video games. I mean, at one point, they started this segment called the Illiterates Book Club, where every podcast or every two podcasts, I think it was, they would pick a new, like, retro game for all of them to play through and then talk about on the next podcast. And every now and then, you know, they'd bring in guests or whatever to talk about whatever it was that they were playing that week. And one of the segments was on Nights into Dreams, and they invited me on to talk about the game because, you know, I would consider myself a somewhat big Knights fan. I only own, like, three copies of the game, the 3D controller, you know, all that fun stuff. I own, you know, a CD single of Dreams, Dreams, the theme song to Nights into Dreams. Lovely souvenirs a friend bought me in Japan when he traveled there many, many years ago. And, you know, they brought me onto their free-to-play podcast for the Illiterates Book Club on Nights into Dreams, and I was sort of ambushed about the game because everyone on that podcast hated it. They played the HD remaster, and I was totally unprepared. I was probably the least prepared I've ever been in my entire life. For them to just be like, hey, come on our podcast and defend this video game. Tell us why it's good. And, you know, up to that point, I just sort of existed in, like, the good vibes of liking Nights into Dreams, but never really thinking that deeply on why I liked it. And certainly, like, you know, again, I say I've had this idea for a video on Nights, this sort of documentary about how to play it or whatever, but I, up to that point, I'd also never really seriously considered why I liked Nights. It was just, it was a fast score-based game, and I liked fast score-based games, I guess. And again, that's probably something I also don't really talk about in the documentary enough, come to think of it. Anyway, it was this whole thing where they were asking me all these really hard questions, and this was like the third podcast I'd ever been on. Well, that's also not true, for reasons we won't get into now, but it was the first podcast I'd been on in a long time. You know, it was probably the second time I'd been on the Nitro Beard podcast, and just being ambushed, you know, why do you like it? I don't know why I like it, I just do. You know, that was tantamount to my response to them, and it just really bothered me that that was my response, that I couldn't really articulate anything intelligent about that game. And that was probably the real true genesis of this script starting to get written. Like I said, you know, it had existed in several forms, both written down and in my head over the years. But this was the first time where I really sat down and really kind of got into the nitty gritty of what Nights into Dreams was. And at this point, the script is something like 12 or 13 pages long. after going through and proofreading it, you know, trying to fix it up and correct, you know, factual errors that I made many, many years ago, things like that. I had text-to-speech run through the script, sort of read it back at me, and I recorded it in Audacity so that, you know, I'd know how long it would take to read through the script. And I think it came up like 38 minutes long. I'll actually play a clip here because one thing that also made me realize is that like text-to-speech is getting really good. Every now and then it'll hit like a word that it doesn't really know how to pronounce super well. And like in a game like Knights especially, there's like a lot of weird spellings and things like that that it kind of gets tripped up on. But in general, like text-to-speech is getting really, really good. Take a listen to this snippet from the script.
As the airliner left the runway and ascended into the sky, one of Sonic Team's programmers had a stroke of inspiration. What if there was a game that could capture the sensation of flight? The freedom, the grace, the thrill of dancing your way through the clouds. This programmer was Yuji Naka, and though he was a wizard when it came to doing the impossible in video games, even he admitted that the Sega Genesis wasn't advanced enough to capture his dreams of flying. It was an idea for the future, and in the meantime, Sonic Team went back to working on what they were good at. By 1995, the 16-bit era was coming to an end, and on the horizon was the next generation of gaming hardware, the Sega Saturn. Offering two discrete processors, each one was more than four times as powerful as the Sega Genesis. In the 3 years since Sonic 2, Yuji Naka had moved up the corporate ladder. Though he still was Sonic Team's lead programmer, Naka-san was taking charge as a leader for the group, inching closer to becoming more of a director for the team. When it came time for Sonic Team to start producing software for the Saturn, he used his clout to take his team in the obvious direction. It was time to fly.
Like, isn't that wild? Like, it almost sounds like a person. Like, every now and then, you know, it feels kind of like there's a crackling sound or something, or like it kind of enunciates on a word a little bit too long, but it sounds almost human in a really weird, almost creepy way. Anyway, after I get done with the Final Fantasy VII Remake review, I was actually thinking about, like I said, finally getting production started on this Knights video. After I had the computer voice read the script to me, I almost actually just thought about recording my voiceover right then and there, which is usually like the first honest signal that production is beginning on something. So, you know, maybe that's coming, maybe it's not. I'm still very afraid of that Knights video. It is going to be a hefty one, let's say. I've also been thinking about doing a video about how I do music, but I've never, like, I think I've talked about this before on this podcast, and I've never really known if it's that good of an idea, because I'm really sensitive about, you know, my music production process, and by that I mean, like, I have zero self-esteem for myself. I think what I do isn't very good, but somehow I've gotten good at doing it. So it's this weird thing where I have this desire deep down where I want to show off my process, but I'm also afraid of showing off my process, like I'm going to be exposed as the fraud that I am. Because, you know, deep down I think that I am kind of a fraud when it comes to my music. Because it's technically not even my music, right? I look for MIDIs I find on the internet, I import them into FL Studio, I play around with them a bit, I add, you know, better instrument samples, better effects, I sort of, you know, tweak, I equalize them, I master them, whatever you want to call it, and then I export them. I did not make the notes. I did not make the song. I just kind of made it sound good, and even whether or not it sounds good is probably up for debate. And it's one of those things where, like, over the years, you know, I've really looked for, like, validation on my music, or the music. I don't even know how to define it there. I've looked for validation from, like, friends or whatever, you know, does this sound good? What do you think I should change? You know, I've occasionally tried to get, like, friends who are better musicians than I am to sort of give me feedback on what I could do better. And universally, I get ignored when that happens. And that's, like, kind of a depressing thought to have, you know, a depressing realization to have, I guess. that nobody ever really tells me what's good, what's bad, what I could do to improve. I've just sort of carved out this very weird niche for myself where I feel like I'm doing everything wrong, but in the best way possible. So I don't know. I want to do this video about my process, but I don't know if it would be a good idea, which to me instinctively means it's a bad idea. But it's a bad idea that I want to do? I don't know, man. It's weird. Everything in my life is weird. I'm a weird person. But maybe that's why you're here. I don't know. On other fronts, we got like a review survey at TSSC News for a Sakura Wars, review code for the PlayStation 4. If you don't know Sakura Wars, there's like sort of like a pseudo reboot slash sequel coming out for PlayStation 4 soon. In the West, I should say. I think it's already been out in Japan for a while. Sakura Wars is kind of like, it was originally like a strategy RPG, and footage of this reboot makes it look sort of like now it's like an action RPG. It's always been about like schoolgirls in kimonos piloting mecha, which is a very Japanese anime sort of thing. Anyway, Sega sent us a review survey about that, about getting a review code for Sakura Wars, and apparently we didn't get it because it is the 27th here as I'm recording this. And I think the game comes out on the 29th and they never sent us a review code, which usually means that they're not going to send us one. And I say usually, but this would be the first review code they haven't ever sent us. So I don't know what's going on that front. I'm currently playing Final Fantasy VII Remake for review instead. I'd rather play that if I had an option between Sakura Wars and Final Fantasy VII. I would definitely pick Final Fantasy. So, you know, it's not going to be something that I'm going to press super hard with Tristan, my boss. It's just, you know, it's just kind of a bummer. Or maybe it's not a bummer. Maybe we'll get a review code here any second now. It'd be kind of close to release, but who even really knows? But that's something that fell through, which is a bummer, you know? I was kind of afraid of the game originally when I first heard that they were rebooting or making a sequel to Sakura Wars, because I don't like strategy RPGs. I don't like turn-based strategy. I don't like strategy in general. You know, my cousin Matt always roped me into playing, like, Command & Conquer, Age of Empires, you know, these RTS games with him. And, you know, begrudgingly, I'd play with him because he'd force me to. And sometimes I'd have fun. You know, it wasn't really that bad, but my problem with strategy RPGs is that I play them as slow as humanly possible. I like to turtle up, gather up more than enough resources, and then steamroll my opponent. And the games don't always let you do that. And that's when I get frustrated, because I am terrible at planning strategies out. If, like, at some point, me and my cousin Matt used to actually, like, fight each other in real-time strategy games, and we stopped doing that because one of two things would happen. One, we'd both turtle up and the matches would go on for 2, 3, 4 hours. Or two, he would rush me and kill me in 10 minutes. And there was nothing I could ever do about it. I would try and rush him in return and it would never work out. He would win every single match. So that's why when we started playing real-time strategy games together, we started playing on the same team and then just stomping computer players. Because otherwise, I just can't handle it. But then I heard that this Sakura Wars game is different. This PlayStation 4 reboot, whatever you want to call it, is sort of an action RPG now. Like, I didn't watch too much footage of it because I was kind of thinking that maybe I'd get the game for review. But a friend linked me to like some gameplay footage from the Japanese release. And it does seem to be more that you're running around in real time, like attacking in real time. It looks much more like, I don't know, like a Phantasy Star Online dungeon crawler. You know, you're still in like these big robots or whatever, but it's not turn-based and it's not strategy anymore. So I don't know. It's kind of a bummer that I'm not getting that game, but at the same time, I'm in the middle of a big action RPG right now. Anyway, so I'd rather play Final Fantasy. Sega also just like yesterday sent us a review code for Sega Ages G-Lock Battle, which is an old arcade game, sort of like a spiritual sequel to Afterburner, I think. A little bit more simulation focused, which is not that great. You know, I can't really talk about that right now. The embargo doesn't lift for like another 3 days, I think. But we just got a review in for that. I'll be writing a review for that. It's an arcade game, so it's fairly simple. I should be able to chew through that here in the next day or two. And then something else I've been like mulling over, probably a really bad idea, is like a Patreon exclusive video series where I go back through like my old video reviews and sort of provide commentary about that. But like, it's the sort of thing where I'm not really on camera, I'm not really acting. So it's one of those things, I'm not really sure if that's a good idea or not. It would be this weird thing where I'm talking over myself, talking over gameplay footage, and that sounds like a nightmare, frankly. But maybe it could be like, you know, like a short montage video where I pick out specific moments of old videos and talk about them. I don't know. That was just like a weird random thought that entered my head the other day and I wrote it down. Let me know if you think that's a good idea, because I generally don't have any idea whether it's a good idea or not. But that's things upcoming on the YouTube channel and game development and in writing and everything else. And I guess for now, it's time for a break. No middle segment again this month. I think I wanted to try reading out the ridiculous dinosaur facts that my cousin sent in, but those were like back in September. So I think I'm going to skip them. And at this point, you probably know you should go check out PsyCutlery. PsyCutlery.eyesandeverything.com for a really cute indie game about a girl in a frog suit who teams up with a psychic spork and they go on an adventure. If you would like me to promote a YouTube channel, an indie game, or just, you know, you can just send me a message, a question, and I'll read it out here on the air. As long as you're a Patreon donor, just send an email to podcast@bltn.net and I'll read it out here for the internet to hear. Did I just rhyme here with here? That kind of sucks. Anyway, here is a break. We'll come back with movies and video games and things that I've been playing. We'll talk a little bit about Final Fantasy VII Remake. We're back. Kind of want to get through this real quick because it's getting pretty late here. It's about 3 o'clock in the morning. I realized like I started this podcast saying maybe this would come out by like the 29th. I'm thinking that's probably like way too far in the future. Like sometimes these podcasts take me a little while to edit them down. Not for any good reason. Sometimes I just get really lazy about it. But it's the 27th right now and it's the 27th past midnight, so I have, like, all day today, all day tomorrow. This should probably actually come out on, like, the 28th, I'd hope, at any rate. But we're now on the second half of the podcast, where, you know, I talk about movies I've been watching, TV shows I've been watching, games I've been playing, and I report that I haven't really been watching a lot of movies. I know that I was talking, I think, just last month about watching a lot more movies. Last 2 months, actually. Since, you know, my YouTube subscriptions, I've culled some people that post a lot of videos or, like, you know, groups have broken up or whatever else. And that normally was giving me more time to watch movies and TV shows. And then, like, I don't know, since the whole pandemic started, like, in addition to, like, you know, working on that Bubsy fan game, now playing Final Fantasy VII Remake, playing Panzer Dragoon Remake, playing G-Lock Battle, it's just been kind of hard for me to focus these last couple weeks on any one particular thing. Even, like, with Final Fantasy VII Remake, you know, there was a period of almost a week where I didn't play it at all. And, you know, now I think I'm on, like, the second or third day where I haven't really played it. I've been, like, even, it's not like I'm filling that time watching YouTube either. Like, I'm super behind on my YouTube subscriptions as well. It's just, it's been a weird time. I don't remember if it was last month or the month before this, but I did watch, like, two episodes of season three of Castlevania, and I watched, like, two episodes of The Mandalorian on my cousin's Plex server, and those were okay, but I can't really, you know, there's not really much to talk about when you only see two episodes like that. Specifically, like, with Castlevania, you know, like, barely anything happened in those two episodes. It was just a lot of, like, catching up with characters that we used to know from previous two seasons. And, you know, The Mandalorian, I think literally the episode I stopped on was right when he gets to Baby Yoda. So, you know, not too much to talk about there, other than, you know, I guess those were okay. I guess those were cool. Partially related to this, probably should have gone in the first segment, really. I've started to transfer some of my IMDb movie reviews over to Letterboxd. No real, like, good logical reason for that, other than Letterboxd seems like a better community for those reviews, possibly. It really feels like IMDb can feel a little bit stuffy at times. You know, you kind of get, like, this weird, almost Wikipedia vibe from it or something. And, like, that probably means nothing unless you've spent significant time, like, editing Wikipedia. Because, you know, way back in the day, I used to edit Wikipedia articles. I was actually involved in this thing where somebody wrote a Wikipedia article about me and about my game, my Super Mario Blue Twilight game. It used to have its own Wikipedia entry. So, you know, I ended up getting embroiled in this whole thing where it was, like, this argument over whether or not the game was notable enough to have its own Wikipedia article, and it was this weird thing where I probably shouldn't have been involved, but the person who made the article got me involved, and, you know, I ended up editing other Wikipedia articles around that time. And Wikipedia, at least back then, was kind of a nightmare. You know, it was all very much, and it still is, I guess, trying to figure out what is worth having an article about, what is worth having on Wikipedia. Like, even just, like, sections, what's worth giving it its own section? You know, obviously, you know, citing your sources, that was a big, like, sticking point for a lot of things. Just a whole big, like, anal retentive mess, essentially. And that's kind of the vibe I get from IMDb sometimes. Though, you know, if you also spend any length of time on IMDb, especially, like, popular new movies, and you go into, like, the trivia section or whatever it is, those are also, like, just a giant, messy nightmare of people, like, entering the same kinds of trivia over and over and over again, like, just repeating the same factoids, like, two or three or four times. And I know enough about IMDb's editing tools that it is incredibly difficult to go in and flag repetitive information for deletion. And it just, you know, it piles up and up and up and up. And then you get this one guy who goes into the trivia section and he's like, oh, this is the second movie where Tom Holland works with Michelle Rodriguez. And you're like, do we really need to know which movies every single actor in the film has co-starred with? Just all this really tiny, useless minutiae, or minutiae, I guess I should say. That's the actual word. That's one of those things where you think about it in your brain, and you don't think about how to say it, and you don't connect the two words. Anyway, I'm just putting them over on Letterboxd, because Letterboxd seems a lot more focused on user reviews. Like, if you go to a movie's page on Letterboxd, there is like three panels on that film's page. It is where you can watch it right now, which would be like, you know, Netflix, Hulu, Amazon Prime. You have a very short description of what the movie is, which, you know, just this bare synopsis. And then you have user reviews. That's all that's on Letterboxd. So in theory, my reviews from IMDb, my user reviews for movies, would have a better lifespan on Letterboxd, I would expect. I don't know. You know, I'm also not like super proud of my movie reviews. I am definitely better at writing reviews for video games. With movie reviews, I'm always worried about like spoiling plot details. So I never like want to get too deep into describing what the movie is about. And never wanting to describe like specific scenes or sequences or anything like that. Because I don't want to like spoil anything. And both IMDb and Letterboxd, you know, they have like, this review contains spoilers. You know, there's like a checkbox for that. So I don't want to like get into the weeds about that kind of stuff because I don't like being spoiled about movies. So I try not to spoil other people about movies. But yeah, just that's something that's going on. I'll link my Letterboxd account in the show notes if you want to go follow me there. But it's just been a thing where like, two or three or four movies a day, I'll take one from my IMDb account and I'll put it on Letterboxd. And usually when I do that, you know, I'll go through and sort of update the review a little bit to kind of like match my current writing voice. I'm not necessarily changing the content of the review itself. It's just like if I find something where I think, you know, I wouldn't use this wording nowadays. You know, maybe I should write this section to be a little bit clearer. You know, I'll do that. I'm kind of revising these reviews to read better, read more clearly as I go. So the reviews that end up on Letterboxd are actually probably, if you've read my IMDb reviews before, and I doubt you have, I don't, like, many people probably haven't, because I'm not that, like, popular on IMDb or anything like that. But if you have, then the ones I'm posting on Letterboxd will be a little bit different. Not, like, super different, but different enough. Anyway, that's something that's happening over there, you know, whatever. I did end up watching Danny O'Dwyer play through all of Half-Life Alyx. Obviously, I myself do not have a VR headset, and I know I went like super hard last month on the fact that I didn't think that Half-Life Alyx needed a VR headset, and watching Danny O'Dwyer play through Alyx kind of changed my opinion in that regard. Like, you know, obviously I'm not so sure that it needs the three-dimensional depth of stereoscopic vision. But the one thing that that Let's Play really, like, hammered home for me is that Half-Life Alyx is probably the best application of motion controls probably since, like, Wii Sports, right? It's sort of incredible how much that game is about using your hands. And not just using your hands, but, like, multitasking with your hands. Like, using your left hand to operate machinery and your right hand to shoot a gun, right? Or using your left hand to throw something and using your right hand to like operate machinery. You know, it's one of those things where it's very integral for you to be able to do two things at one time, and having two separate hand inputs really helps with that. And specifically, like, Half-Life Alyx is very much a game about catching and throwing. You know, you're throwing grenades, you're catching ammunition, because if you don't know, like, the big mechanic of that game are these gloves you have called the Russells, and they are essentially like that game's gravity gun. If you remember Half-Life 2, you get this gravity gun where you can pull objects and you can shoot them. In Half-Life Alyx, you get these gloves. And it's the sort of thing where you point at something at the environment and you flick your wrist and it throws it at you. So you see like a clip of ammo on a shelf across the room. You point at it and you flick your wrist up and it kind of like, it's like it jerks a string and the object comes flying at you and you have to use your hands to catch it. And there are like hundreds of those interactions in the game. I like fully expect people who play Half-Life Alyx, if they're like not good at playing catch, I assume the game is going to make them, you know, absolutely excellent at catching things in real life, because that's kind of the skill you need. You need to, you know, put your hand in a specific position so that you can catch the object that you just, you know, basically threw at yourself. And there's just lots of interactions where you're kind of rummaging through trash or shelves or whatever else, where you need that physicality of working with your hands so that you can, you know, you can pick up stuff, you can sweep stuff off. You can reach around like garbage cans and dig through the trash and pull out, you know, resin to upgrade your gun or whatever. And it's just, it is an incredibly smart looking usage, because again, I don't have a VR headset, I've never played this game, but it looks incredibly smart with the way it uses motion controls. I think I was saying elsewhere, I almost feel like I covered this last month's podcast, but maybe I even said it earlier in this podcast. I don't know. It's 3 o'clock in the morning, folks, but it is the best usage of motion controls since Wii Sports. It is just really, it looks absolutely incredible. And I can't wait until the day 2 years from now, 5 years from now, who even knows how many years from now, that I finally get my own VR headset to play Half-Life Alyx. Because it's also just like, it's like a light gun shooter, right? It's like House of the Dead 2, except imagine if House of the Dead 2 gave you total freedom of movement, where at any time you could just walk around the zombies. You didn't have to stand in one place and shoot them like a shooting gallery. You could strafe, you could switch guns, you know, it looks great. And there are like so many like creative sections in the middle of that game, you know, monsters that are blind but can hear you. It's one of those things where it's like, you know, who knew that Valve could still make a good game, right? Because all they've done, you think about Artifact was a disaster. That was their collectible card game. They've kind of been coasting on Counter-Strike and Team Fortress and Dota 2 forever, you know. I'm sure they put plenty of heart and soul and care into updates, at least for Counter-Strike and Dota, but it also sort of feels like, you know, it's just business as usual. It's very predictable. It's just them going through the motions, essentially. And also, those are multiplayer games, you know, that's a very different consideration than a single-player story-driven game, but just everything from dialogue to animations to set-piece design and counter design, it is just, it's perfect, basically. I mean, it's not the perfect game, but as far as wanting to go back to the Half-Life 2 universe, going back to City 17, it's perfect. You know, it's a very excellent looking game. Will it say VR? I don't know. The ending implies that Valve wants to make more Half-Life games, possibly in VR. So we'll see what happens with regards to that. That the ending to Half-Life Alyx is very interesting, I'd say. It is also very much a Half-Life ending, which in itself, if you really think about it, is probably a little bit of a spoiler. But it's not so much of a spoiler that I'm going to worry about it, because honestly, that could mean anything. Anyway, I also subscribe to Chip and Ironicus finally. I mean, if you don't know who those guys are, they're very much old guard, something awful Let's Play forum guys. You know, very, very old guard. Like, you know, you think about like the Retsu Prey channel, right? Chip and Ironicus were involved in that almost from the beginning. And that we're talking like 15 years ago, you know, they've been around for a very, very, very long time. Probably, you know, among some of the pioneers of the Let's Play genre, let's call it. And I subscribe to them because they're doing a Super Mario Odyssey Let's Play. And even though I own Super Mario Odyssey already, I watched Super Best Friends play through Super Mario Odyssey. I just cannot get enough of Super Mario Odyssey. And, you know, Chip and Ironicus, they have a good rapport. If you've never watched, like, their Duck Dynasty Let's Play, there was an Xbox 360 Duck Dynasty game. That was fantastic. I know about that. kind of tempted to watch their Metal Gear Let's Plays, but that's the sort of thing where, like, I own all the Metal Gear games, or I own most of them. And I just, there's a part of me that would rather play them myself. So it's one of those things, I don't know if I'd want to watch them play Metal Gear, but also Chip is a very, very, very big Metal Gear fan. So that would be a treat. I know I did end up, I started watching their Metal Gear Rising Let's Play at one point, and I never really got super far into that. I'm not entirely sure why. I might have just been the sort of thing where I wasn't subscribed to them yet, you know? They also were, I don't think they do it anymore, but they were doing a charity marathon called Gextra Life, where the very first year, they just played all the Gex games. And then last year, or 2018, I think was the last time they did it, they just played like random shovelware, which was really fun. You know, those are worth checking out. But their Super Mario Odyssey Let's Play is also just fantastic, and it's been going for like forever. They've been doing this Let's Play for something like 3 years at this point. You know, the very first episode, they talk about how the game's only like 6 months old, and, you know, they're still putting out new episodes to this day. I just watched one like a couple hours ago. And that's because they're also trying to go for 500 moons. You know, they're trying to go for, it's, wouldn't really call it 100% completion, because there is kind of no such thing as 100% completion for Super Mario Odyssey. That game is almost by design built to be something that kind of goes forever. It really does sound like, you know, you can get 999 moons in that game, just because it kind of is designed to always feed you more stuff, basically forever. So, you know, 500 moons is kind of like the cutoff for the absolute final world content of that game. It's when you open, like, the final challenge, the hardest challenge. And it's also kind of gotten me into replaying some of Super Mario Odyssey. The episode I watched of their Let's Play today, they finally hit 500 moons, which I think means that, well, they're doing this thing where, like, so they played through all the levels once. They did a bunch of objectives then, and now they're kind of going back through a second, or for some of the worlds, even like a third time, and picking up all the stuff that they missed. So they are sort of nearing the end of the game there on, in, like, their second time through. They just finished, like, the, what is it? It's like the Snowflake Kingdom or whatever, with the bouncy round walrus guys. So I think there's only like two or three more worlds left until they can finally, you know, get to the Dark Side of the Moon quests, and then the final challenge called the Darker Side of the Moon. And in my own game, I think I ended up leaving off on Super Mario Odyssey somewhere around, like, the 300 moon mark originally, however much I got by the time I originally beat that game. And now that they're having me go through Super Mario Odyssey all over again a second time myself, I think I'm up to like 482 moons. So I am also kind of, you know, closing in on that 500 moon goal, and I kind of want to go for it. It's one of those things where, like, you can just buy moons in that game after a certain point with coins. If you just want to cheat your way up to the 500 milestone, as it were. And I thought about it, about, you know, just paying for the moons to get up to that point. But I also wanted to buy, like, the costumes, right? Zombie Mario, Skeleton Mario. But those costumes are, like, you know, 5,000 coins, 9,000 coins. You know, these ridiculous numbers. And if I unlock the Darker Side of the Moon and I clear the Darker Side of the Moon, well, if I clear the Darker Side of the Moon, I never did beat Champions Road on Super Mario 3D Land. But if I do that, then there's kind of nothing left for me to do in the game. I know I said Super Mario Odyssey is this game that is designed to sort of be played indefinitely, but I'm not entirely sure how that goes. Like, I know Chip mentioned that after a certain point, it sounds like the game gets extra hard challenges added to it. Like, you know, a whole new slate of, like, super difficult moons for every world. So maybe that's something that happens, like, you know, maybe it's sort of like a Super Mario 3D Land sort of thing where, you know, Super Mario 3D Land, you finish that game once and then you get like the hard mode version of everything. And the hard mode version of Super Mario 3D Land is where things really get going. You know, that's where that game becomes like my favorite Mario game ever made, is in the second quest of Super Mario 3D Land, because that's when it feels like, you know, the first quest, the original quest in that game, feels a little too easy and a little too boring, and the second quest is like the game you want. And I maybe that's something similar happens with Super Mario Odyssey, where once you clear Darker Side of the Moon or whatever, maybe it, you know, all the challenges, all the moons get reset and suddenly you're on the second quest where everything's super difficult, which would be kind of crazy because there are parts of Super Mario Odyssey that are already pretty difficult. But we'll find out. We'll get there eventually. You know, the Let's Play will probably get there long before I do, because I have other games that I'm sort of mandated to play, as it were. Obviously, I have played Panzer Dragoon Remake. There is a review on tssenews.com if you would like to read that. It's okay. It's not... I saw someone on Twitter say that it really reminded them of the Sega Ages remakes for PlayStation 2. And that I would say is pretty spot on, but the example that I used is that it really reminds me of like an HD remaster that comes to Xbox Live Arcade in like 2009, right? Where it's this, you know, this weird sort of half step where they're trying to replicate an old game in the wrong way, but they kind of get there anyway, and like the graphics are a little weird, and they're clearly fans of the original game, but it's just a little bit off in a lot of weird ways. It's a little bit cheap in a lot of weird ways. And that's exactly the way I feel about Panzer Dragoon Remake. It's not like the worst thing in the universe, but it's very rough around the edges in ways that are kind of a bummer. And they become even more of a bummer if you go back and play, say, like Panzer Dragoon Orta on the original Xbox, which is something that I did as part of the review for Panzer Dragoon Remake. And Panzer Dragoon Orta is this, you know, very beautiful 2003 Xbox game. The controls are nice and smooth. You know, it kind of like automatically tracks enemies as they fly around your dragon. It's like a soft lock-on feature almost. It's a very nice feeling game. And then you go back to Panzer Dragoon Remake and it's not a very nice feeling game. Not a very nice feeling game at all. You know, it feels stiff and weird and budget. But they just announced a patch like the other day, like day before yesterday, where they are going to go back in and they're going to touch up the controls and they're kind of going to add missing content that was supposed to be in there but wasn't. They're going to just go through and give it like a once-over of polish, you know, make everything feel a little bit nicer. So maybe it'll actually end up being like a really nice remake after a certain point. You know, I really did not expect them to go back and sort of give it an extra layer of polish like that. You know, usually these kinds of projects are kind of one and done and they move on and, you know, they never look back. And, you know, this developer in particular has already like announced like a bunch of remakes out of nowhere. Before they were even done with Panzer Dragoon Remake, they announced a remake for Panzer Dragoon 2. They announced remakes for House of the Dead 1 and 2. You know, they announced all this stuff and it's like, guys, slow down. You don't even have one game out yet. But if they are going back and they're cleaning things up and they're touching things up, you know, maybe that's a good sign, or maybe it's a fact that they're going to spend all of their development money patching up their broken job that they kind of didn't do right the first time. I guess we'll just have to wait and see. Final Fantasy VII Remake, of course, is something that I've been playing a lot of. I think I'm up to 20 hours into that game now, just about. Right smack dab in the middle of the halfway point, as it turns out. That game is 18 chapters long, and where I left off is, like, the very beginning of either Chapter 9 or Chapter 10. So, you know, I'm basically right in the middle of that game, about to go to the Wall Market. Very famous scene from this, from the original game. Sort of like Midgar's Red Light District. Very seedy place. And as you may know, that, like, I've been very critical about Final Fantasy VII Remake up to this point. I don't like the art style. I think it's too realistic. I don't like the battle system. I don't like it's this weird sort of half step between real-time action game combat and turn-based RPG combat. And I think some of that still holds, you know, still holds water. You know, I still don't really like this battle system, even though it does have maybe a little more depth than I gave it credit for originally. You know, it's the sort of thing where it's not like it's not fun, but the decisions about, like, the weird ATB meter and stuff like that, I still take umbrage with that. I still don't think it should have been this weird action game hybrid, and I think that's a mistake Square Enix has made in the past, and I think it's a mistake that they'll probably continue to make in the future, because I get the feeling that they are just afraid of turn-based combat. I get the feeling that somebody at that company feels like they're past the point of needing to do turn-based combat, or maybe, like, they're only going to save turn-based combat for, like, Bravely Default, because, you know, we do have Bravely Default 2 coming out at some point in the future. But the surprising thing is, I've been really loving the remake so far. There's just the one thing that I really expected them to get wrong was how to tell this story. Who Cloud Strife is, who Aerith Gainsborough is, gets so mucked up. You know, you think of, like, Final Fantasy VII Advent Children. That is a stupid, terrible, awful movie that mischaracterizes almost everybody that's in it. Cloud doesn't act like Cloud. Aerith doesn't act like Aerith. Nobody is who they are supposed to be. So there was, like, you know, this definite worry that when they remade Final Fantasy VII, that sort of Advent Children vibe would come back around and get injected into the main game. And that is definitely not true. They actually got these characters right in, like, a big, impressive, enjoyable way. You know, not to get too deep into spoilers here, because, again, halfway through the game, don't want to spoil anything. But, like, let's take Aerith, for instance. Obviously, we know a big spoiler about her, what happens to her, but it's her personality is something that's kind of been mutated over time, where, you know, later appearances for her, she's this very almost, like, shy, demure sort of girl. You know, she's very quiet. She's very pure, I guess is a word I'd say. And in Final Fantasy VII, she wasn't really like that. And that's something that Final Fantasy VII Remake gets right. Instead, what Aerith is I think she's a manic pixie dream girl. And if you don't know what that term is, it's a kind of like a filmmaking term. It's a storytelling term. It just basically describes that she's sort of this, how do I say this? I'm probably not that well versed in the term. In fact, I may even be using the term incorrectly, but it basically means that she only exists to prop up the hero, as it were. She's there to sort of be, like, the ideal girlfriend. And I don't mean that in the sense that, like, she is, again, like, you know, the ideal girlfriend, maybe you like demure, pure women. But she's supposed to be, you know, like, fun and bubbly, and she's supposed to, like, break down the walls of the grumpy characters and just sort of be almost like a borderline Mary Sue in a certain way, where, like, you know, she can do no wrong. Everybody loves her. She's sarcastic and, you know, just a better version Gosh, what am I even saying? I don't even know what I'm saying. But she's just a certain type of, like, bubbly, funny, sarcastic sort of character. Sort of, like, designed to be not too cute, not too whatever, but just a person. I don't know how to describe her. I don't know how to describe what a manic pixie dream girl is. You're just going to have to look it up for yourself, because maybe I'm using it incorrectly. You know, there's only one way to find out, and I'm not going to fact check live on the radio. But that's the vibe I get. That's the gut feeling I have about Aerith Gainsborough. And, like, the one thing that I really like about the story is Cloud himself. Cloud is kind of an idiot. He's kind of a jerk. He's kind of a moron. You know, people will tell you that he's a very 90s character. He's very, like, ooh, you know, big, not big, but, like, pretending he's tough, right? He's very much, oh, I don't care about anything. You know, he's that kind of guy, sort of emo and just distant and cold. And so far, the vibe from the story, and maybe this was in the original game, maybe it wasn't. It has been, you know, 20 years since I've played Final Fantasy VII. But the whole game so far seems to kind of be about breaking down Cloud's walls, getting him to loosen up, getting him to stop trying to be such a tough guy. And I know that there's a sequence in the Wall Market that is really going to be about that, about sort of exploring, let's say, a side of Cloud that is very different from a tough macho man. I do remember that from Final Fantasy VII. And it's just really interesting how that's kind of become the theme of the game, really, is just the changing of Cloud Strife from someone who was supposedly in a war, or at least joined the military because of a war and wanted to become, you know, a strong, cool, awesome soldier, and then comes back home, comes back to, like, his old childhood friend, and slowly has those walls, like, broken down so that he loosens up and he starts smiling and he starts joking and he stops being traumatized, I guess. And it's a very interesting way to portray these characters. And there's so much more story in the remake too. So many little asides that weren't there anymore. You know, you get to know other members of Avalanche super well in ways that you didn't in the original game. You know, Biggs, Wedge, and Jesse, they were kind of like these small incidental characters in the original Final Fantasy VII. You know, they kind of exited the story after the first, I don't know, 2 or 3 hours, that I remember anyway. I mean, maybe I'm wrong. And here, you know, you really get, like, side quests with them where you get to know them and you do things for them that wasn't in the original game. So, you know, you learn about their families, you learn about who they were before they joined Avalanche, you know, things like that. And it's just, it's a really smart, cool way to handle this story. But I also know how the remake ends, and I'm not going to spoil that, but I did have a friend spoil it for me so that I'd know what happens at the end, and we're just going to have to wait and see for the review how I feel about that ending once I see it for myself, because it sounds like it gets real wacky pants in a way that the original Final Fantasy VII never would have. It sounds very much like modern Kingdom Hearts, almost, some people have, you know, likened it to, about the really weird directions it goes in as it gets towards the end of the game. So I'll report back on that maybe next month. It should be next month. You know, I really can't linger too much longer here. You may have noticed that I kind of stopped talking about SteamWorld Dig 2. That's because I actually thought I was at the end of the game, and I was sort of putting off going through what I thought was the final area, and as it turns out, I still had, like, another third of that game left to go. Maybe even, like, a half of the game. And it was some point, like, I don't know, 2 weeks ago that I finally picked it up back up again, and I realized, oh, I have so much game left, you know. this place that I thought was the final area is actually, you know, just another plot point in a much larger story. And there's like all this other stuff that I had to do. Now I think I'm actually almost at the end of the game. I don't think I'm at the final area just yet. But I'm sort of running out of upgrades to buy. A lot of the storyline is coming to like a point where, you know, it better be the ending because there's almost nothing left to do in this map. So I really do think I'm coming towards the end of that game. And it's a really good game. You know, that's basically all I can say about it at this point is that, you know, there's just so much more story and lore and so many more things to do than just dig in a sense. I mean, you are still just digging, but there are also now like way more sections that are like challenge rooms. There's way more story, way more characters. The story takes you places where, again, you don't really dig for gold or anything. It's more just kind of like a platforming challenge or like a combat challenge. There's a lot more like genuine puzzle solving, a lot more like sort of Metroid style revisiting areas you've already been. And there was some of that in SteamWorld Dig 1, but now it's just a lot stronger. It's a lot more pushed towards the forefront. Or at least I assume, anyway. Like, that was something else that I realized about SteamWorld Dig 1 recently, is that I can't remember a lot of that game. I finished SteamWorld Dig 1 on, like, 3 or 4 different platforms, and I don't remember hardly anything that happens in that game. I can't tell you any of the power-ups I equipped. I can't tell you most of the areas I visited. I can't tell you almost anything about the challenge rooms I went through, but I finished that game on the 3DS, on the Wii U, and on the PC. And to finish a game 3 times and not remember anything about it is pretty weird. I'm thinking and hoping that SteamWorld Dig 2 will stick in my mind a lot better. But I just, you know, to go back to SteamWorld Dig 1, I think I also just liked that game because it was so chill and relaxing, you know. I think I talked about this a month or two ago, that just, you know, sifting through the dirt, looking for jewels is very, like, relaxing. And maybe that's a reason why I can't remember anything, is because I was just, you know, so chilled out playing that game that I wasn't, it was almost like a trance at that point. I don't know. Weird. Very weird. And then just very recently, like within the last 2 or 3 days here, Super Mario Maker 2 got its final big update, and it is a doozy. It adds Super Mario Bros. 2 power-ups, it expands all kinds of stuff in the Super Mario 3D World style, and it finally adds world maps. You can now bundle levels together into basically your own Super Mario game. And that is a very cool idea on the surface, but it was handled in the most Nintendo way possible, which is to say you can only upload one world at a time, and there's basically no search functionality. It's actually incredibly difficult to go back and replay worlds you haven't finished yet. There's no, like, well, there is like a dedicated section for it, but it's hard to find. It's buried under like 4 menus. And it's just, it's a really weird way to implement that. But at least we have it now. You know, that the World Maker update is finally what has really gotten me thinking that I should make Super Mario Maker 2 levels. I haven't gotten there yet. I've only played like a couple of other people's worlds. And that's not like the other thing. I don't think you can even really rate worlds. There's no like rating system for you to say, you know, here's a really good world, I think everyone should play it. It's just worlds are a thing that exists as a menu option. And you're presented with like this galaxy map with like 8 different worlds. And there's no way to tell if they're any good or any bad. You just have to pick a random one and hope for the best. But, you know, that's... I'm probably going to make Super Mario Maker 2 levels now, just for the sake of building my own world, building my own game, as much of a game as I can make. But it's one of those things where, like, I need to look up a wiki and figure out like how the environment types work, what all's at my disposal. You know, do I want to do it all in one style? Like, do I want to make the entire game Super Mario Brothers 3 themed? Do I want to mix and match? Do I want to break up themes by world? Like, would we have an entire Super Mario World world? Would we have an entire new Super Mario Brothers world? You get it, what I'm saying. Those are all things that I have to stop and consider, and who knows, that might actually... I might end up forgetting about making levels for Super Mario Maker 2 because I won't be able to decide on how the level should look and play and whatever else. But it's something that I do want to do now. It's definitely stoked my fires of inspiration. Particularly, like, one of the things that bummed me out was that I made levels for Super Mario Maker... Super Mario Maker 1 that would not be playable in Super Mario Maker 2. One of the levels I was very proud of in Mario Maker 1 was this one called Prisoner of War, where you use the Super Mario Bros. 1 costumes to like either transform you into a Goomba, or I wanted you to be able to transform into the Shellcracker costume so that you'd look kind of like a Koopa Troopa. And it was all kind of like this sort of stealth thing where you were sneaking along as a line in a line of Goombas as a Goomba. And when they like unveiled the updated costumes for Super Mario 3D World Style in Mario Maker 2, they actually showed that you can wear the Goomba hat from Super Mario 3D World. And they actually had a little section of level that looked nearly identical to my Prisoner of War level. So they very obviously had very similar ideas to the ones I had back in Mario Maker 1. So that's a level that I can now transfer over to Mario Maker 2. You know, it won't be using the Super Mario Bros. 1 style, but, you know, it's good enough. So that's definitely something that I'm interested in trying. But that's probably going to wrap up this podcast here. It's getting close to 4 o'clock in the morning here. My throat hurts. Some of that is from allergies, because, you know, it is the season for the sneezing, as it were. So I'm gonna go rest my vocal cords, rest my throat, turn off this recording. Hopefully it'll be up by tomorrow, which would be actually later today on the 27th, and then I will get back to Final Fantasy VII, I'll get back to G-Lock Battle, write some reviews, and I'll see you guys then. So stay tuned for that stuff. Bye.